Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday, time for a Vault episode. This one is part two of our series on the psychology of architecture that originally aired in December of 2019. This episode was on the 12th, and here it is again for you today. We hope you enjoy.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And we are back with part two of our exploration of architecture in the mind.
That's right. In our first episode, which we do encourage you to go back and listen to if you have not already, we discussed the natural world, and then we discussed the architectural world, this world of artificial shapes and objects and designs and layouts that we've made out of that natural world. And in many cases, we find ourselves living almost exclusively within those environments, the environments of cities especially.
Yeah, we discussed studies about the psychological and cognitive impacts of different types of interior spaces, things like color of interior spaces, ceiling height, and all kinds of stuff like that. Today, we're taking a turn into the cursed realm.
That's right. So to best understand the typical functionality of a healthy brain, scientists often study cases of illness and injury. So perhaps to help us better understand the impact of great architecture and even like the different attributes of everyday architecture, we should also turn away from the world of vaulted cathedrals and pyramids and ziggurats and instead look at the dark sorcery of architecture, cursed architecture, if you will.
Okay.
By the way, if you do a web search for cursed architecture, you'll find a lot of examples of terrible, usually quite insane home and building designs.
Was this a Twitter account you shared with me?
I think cursed architect or cursed architecture is a Twitter thing. But also, if you just look around for like worst renovations and so forth, there are a number of different websites that will include a host of these photos. A lot of them hosted on like Pinterest or Instagram. But I swear, I was looking at some of these last Friday, and I was by myself laughing out loud so hard at them.
Yes.
And sometimes I couldn't even really quite put a finger on why.
Yes, but I know exactly what you mean. I was also laughing really hard at this stuff you sent me. The one I love the ones where there is like
a ledge that cannot be accessed in any way.
Yes.
It's almost like the places where there's like, you know, a room with a high ceiling, and then against the wall up above, you know, where the second floor would be, there's like a hallway, but there are no stairs leading to it.
Yeah, stairways to nowhere. You know, weird doors to nowhere, or doors in the middle of walls. You know, mm-hmm. anything where stairs have been altered drastically are a great source of hilarity in these shots. And it's weird to try and like figure out exactly why some of these are funny, because you know, sometimes it's people just doing the best with the limitations of an old building, right? An already weird layout, say, or an older, larger building that has been sliced into apartments. Uh-huh. I remember visiting London with my wife like 15 years ago, I think, and staying in a weird old hotel where the first thing you did when you entered the room uh-huh. was walk down a flight of stairs. Uh-huh. You know, things like that. But then again, like given the limitations of the building, perhaps that was the best way to go about it.
Oh, I recently stayed in a building in Paris with a hilarious staircase. It was like a spiral staircase. It wasn't quite a spiral. It was like a rectangular spiral staircase. And there was no stair there that was flat. I mean, it was angled one way or another, even out or in. And I imagine going up those things after a night out on the town might be quite perilous.
We had a work trip we had to do to Chicago once. We stayed in a hotel, if I'm remembering this correctly, and on every floor there was a short stairway to a wall.
Going nowhere,
except to a painting, I think.
Like a painting of a creepy fairy woman.
Yeah, it was weird. So that sort of stuff. There's that sort of stuff. But then there are other examples where it's like clearly somebody just did not care or uh-huh. did not have time to care and did not look back to correct it. Things where like a toilet can no longer close because there's an overhang in the way. you know, weird cases where a water faucet comes out over the edge of a small sink mm-hmm. or does not come out far enough to actually empty into the sink.
Some of them just had gross implications. I think there was one I was looking at that was just like a bathroom with a ton of urinals and like a thick shag carpet floor.
Yeah, any kind of carpeted bathroom scenario is awful. But yeah, I love the ones though where not only did whoever, you know, renovated this, because clearly there's not really design elements there. Not only did they fail, but someone did this and thought, close enough. They just leave it.
Right, yeah.
And this gets back to this idea of design, though. Like, there is this ideal version in mind where an architect is consulted. You know, they're architects, they're engineers, and there's this process of intentional design before something is built. But of course, historically and even sometimes contemporarily, that's not always the same. For instance, I was talking with a friend of mine recently about how when they were younger, they were they had this job and they were helping somebody build some buildings, and there was just kind of the sense of like, well, we're just going to throw it up. We're just going to throw up some walls. And
yeah,
just,
you know what goes into a building. You've got to have a floor. You got to have walls, roof, you know.
Yeah, and so I guess, you know, certainly with older buildings, and it's going to vary in different parts of the world, you know, there may be less intent in what is being built. It may be more about we need a structure. At the end of the week, let's build a structure. And maybe the individuals building it are not quite the craftspeople that the task requires. But it's one thing to screw up a renovation or to monumentally fail on a toilet installation. It's quite another to actually design and construct an entire building or multiple buildings that have a debilitating effect on our mental well-being.
Yeah.
And the world is full of examples in which a stark or a less traditional architectural design draws the ire of local inhabitants, right? Often due to the fact that it replaced a more traditional building and or stands alongside traditional examples.
Yeah.
And you can pretty much you can drive around any major city and you can see that. You can see, all right, traditional building. Weird modern building, and you can be almost positive that at some point the neighbors were upset about this or maybe are still upset about this.
Oh, yeah. It seems like every major city, if you talk to the locals, they'll have like the one ugly building that they hate.
Yeah. And blogs are devoted to this sort of thing as well. Now, for my money, I sometimes find this a bit dumb. Sometimes someone builds a cool modern home alongside a bunch of traditional little boxes, and people with a more traditional taste, they get bent out of shape over it. And I think we have to realize that some of us want to live in weird gothic concrete apocalypse bunkers, and that's ultimately okay. But then I go back to the McMansion example we mentioned in the first episode, the idea that, you know, a developer comes along and builds a colossal house, as much houses as possible in a given lot, and that kind of thing I do find obnoxious. But then again, likely somebody comes along and is like, yes, that's the exact amount of house I want, and I don't want to mow a lawn. So to a certain extent, some of these concerns are a bit ridiculous to even get too wrapped up in, right? I mean, it's just people's tastes are going to vary. Some people want traditional, some people want modern, some people want ultra-modern, and some people maybe want to piss off the neighbors.
Oh, sure. I mean, the spite houses are a whole wonderful thing on their own.
Yeah.
We can come back to that. But yeah, I mean, I think one thing that's important to keep in mind as we go forward and think about this subject is the difference between just like our aesthetic preferences and what actually has psychological effects on people. Like the difference between what kind of school building seems nice to you versus what kind of school building actually has measurable outcomes on children's performance in their education.
Absolutely. So in figuring it out and in trying to decide, like, you know, how much of it is to what extent is there some sort of intrinsically debilitating aspect to certain architectural styles or approaches versus this idea of just personal taste, one has to visit the topic of brutalist architecture. Brutalist architecture emerged out of Switzerland, I believe, in the 1950s, was especially popular in the 50s and 60s, and you can find it around the world, but especially in the UK, the US, Canada, Western Europe, and the Eastern Bloc, and the former Soviet Union. And generally, with brutalist architecture, you're dealing with stark, imposing geometric designs built with lots of concrete. It is often stark, and some of what's classified as brutalist I see as beautiful, creative, or even evocative. Some of them the designs feel very, you know, just ultra modern in a way, or sometimes ultra modern in kind of like a retro fashion, you know. Other examples are harder for me to love, but again, your mileage is going to vary when it comes to brutalist architecture.
A lot of what's most recognized in brutalist architecture are these large surfaces of exposed concrete. And in fact, that's where the name comes from. The name of brutalist architecture does not come from it somehow being brutal, like a brutality in Mortal Kombat. Wait, is that a thing, brutality?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. You're the MK expert here.
Yeah.
But no, it comes from the phrase béton brut, which means raw concrete. And that's because it has very often has these large raw concrete features. One example I think we mentioned in the last episode is Boston City Hall, which I think is, you know, one of the most famous brutalist structures, which personally I think is extremely aesthetically pleasing. I like it a lot, though I know a lot of people hate it. It's apparently just a controversial building. I was saying one of the things I like about it is at least from some angles of the building, there are ways that it has sort of like a variable structure that can be like horizontally permeated, but then sort of spreads out as it goes up. And in a way, to me, it is a concrete structure that sort of mimics a forest. Something about it looks kind of like organic, like a copse of trees that you could walk into. And I really like that about it.
Yeah, I look at this image of it and it defies sort of easy identification. Like I look at it and I would not be able to turn and necessarily draw it, you know?
Yeah.
There's something that it asks you to map it out, you know? It feels like an environment of concrete as much as, it is a structure of concrete.
Yeah, and I think it incorporates some of the elements that we were talking about in the last episode that make for good structures. Like it has some patterned complexity. It has this organic feeling type of variability in the structure. It somewhat looks like trees.
Yeah, there's a sort of M.C. Escher vibe to it to a certain extent.
A little bit that too, yeah. But not in a way that makes it functionally confusing.
Right, not in a way where it seems to break the laws of nature or physics or anything. So when we're dealing with architecture of this sort, I think there are a few things we have to realize. First of all, and we'll come back to this later, is that architecture does not exist in a vacuum. Like a building, even just a highly designed building, it is not does not exist independent of, say, what that building is for. It doesn't exist independent of history, et cetera. But another big problem is that architecture is an art form, a design medium, and a product or practice. It's not just about form and function. And art, since it is in part art, is not just about making you feel good. I'll admit that most of my favorite visual artists have you know, typically not been concerned with making people feel good.
Right.
I think of like Irving Norman or H.R. Giger or Bruegel, Bosch. You know, I love these artists, and you might love them too. But do you want them influencing the power of your physical environment? I mean, I suppose on some level you do if you're tempted to frame a print of it on your wall. But would you inflict it upon the neighborhood? Would you inflict it upon a whole city?
Do you want to live in a Bosch painting?
Yeah. So I wanted to discuss a few examples of unpopular buildings buildings that are at least have been very unpopular with segments of the population.
Mm-hmm.
One of them, and I would consider this an extreme example, is the House of Soviets in Kaliningrad, located in Kaliningrad Oblast, an exclave of Russia on the Baltic Sea. And this is a historically Prussian area, but again, it was part of the Soviet Union and is part of Russia today. The House of Soviets is built on the grounds, but not the exact site, of the former Königsberg Castle, which was destroyed during the Second World War. But the House of the Soviets, built in the 70s, does not look like a Teutonic castle. Instead, it is frequently described as looking like the head of a giant robot that has been buried up to the neck in the earth.
It looks like almost kind of a gigantic concrete battery somehow. Yeah.
Yeah,
maybe a huge concrete air conditioning unit with eyes.
Yeah, it does appear to have eyes and kind of a mouth and even horns, perhaps. Some locals have also called it the monster in the past. Again, it's the House of Soviets. If you look it up online, you'll find plenty of pictures of it. I will note that you will find two different versions generally, and that's because it used to have more of a concrete, dark appearance, certainly more brutalist, like clearly brutalist in its appearance, because it is often held up as a great example of brutalist architecture.
Mm-hmm.
But it was in 2005, I believe, which also coincided with a visit by Vladimir Putin, that it was painted a new color. So now it has this awful blue color, which is even worse because it's like you're hiding the fact or covering up the fact that it's brutalist. You know, it's like it's not raw concrete anymore. It is raw concrete that has been painted the color of an Easter egg.
Mm-hmm.
So again, critics consider it one of the worst examples of Soviet architecture, though it has also been held up as a solid example of brutalist architecture. And it's also, I should add, it's a little unfair to completely judge it, even based on the older pictures you'll find of it, because it has never truly been finished. It is technically an unfinished building. It fulfills no purpose as a building to this day.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so again, we have to realize that architecture does not exist in a vacuum. It doesn't exist in its own bubble. History, politics, and culture color our perceptions of them. In its conception, the House of the Soviets was perhaps designed to be, you know, either a symbol of modernity or progress, but it might also be viewed as a tombstone symbolizing Soviet or Russian rule over a historically German city, that sort of thing. Or you might look at it and realize that does nothing. There's nothing going on in there because this was never finished. This is a testament to an unfinished project. But not everything considered brutalist is like a monster level of ugliness, etc. One, I think, great example that kind of, you know, bucks the stereotype for brutalist architecture is Montreal's Habitat 67 complex, which was designed by Moshe Savty, which you need to look up a picture of this as well because I can only describe it so well. It looks like a long horizontal row of randomly stacked boxes at different angles, and it's It's quite interesting to look at, in my opinion, and was actually designed with some of the problems of high-density living in mind.
I think it actually looks kind of interesting. I mean, to me, it somewhat fulfills that, you know, it has some complexity on the exterior surfaces. It has a kind of organic nature to it. It feels more like a natural environment.
Yeah, it basically, and this is like a very crude summary of it. I'm sure that the architect's original words about it were far better expression of it. But it's kind of like, if I have to live right on top of where someone else is living, well, can't I live a little sideways or a little to the left? A little to the right. Uh-huh. And likewise, does the person above me, could they maybe be a little further back, a little to the side? Maybe there's some room in all of this for little courtyards, little porches. And so it does have that kind of ziggurat feel. It has this kind of, it looks kind of like it was made by space age insects.
Uh-huh. It turns concrete box living spaces into something more like a bush of thorns, which that doesn't sound very inviting, but it looks very cool, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. And if I'm remembering correctly, I don't think it was mentioned in the book Future Shock, but I think the kind of campy television adaptation of Future Shock that was hosted by Orson Welles, I think they used images or footage of Habitat 67 talking about like living spaces of the future. Another quick example that's sometimes brought up concerning brutalist architecture from the 1970s, Neve Brown Brutalist Apartment in Rowley Way, London, which has a kind of terraced look to it.
Yeah.
And I think looks quite beautiful. It looks kind of like a stadium turned into apartments, you know. Mm-hmm. I rather like it. But again, it's one of these where it's not that stereotypical idea of brutalist architecture. But again, not everyone likes it either. Now, a huge example of detrimental modern but not brutalist architecture that is often brought up was known as the Pruitt-Igoe housing complex in St. Louis, Missouri. This was built in the 1950s and designed by Minoru Yamasaki of World Trade Center fame.
Huh.
And the complex consisted of 33 apartment blocks, each 11 stories high. And, it actually sums up a lot of the things that Habitat 67 was trying to get away from. Like, if you look at an aerial picture of what this looked like, I mean, it looked like a graveyard for giants.
Yeah.
It's just big slabs of apartment buildings with these big empty spaces in between. And it's tough to look at. As described by Michael Bond in The Hidden Ways That Architecture Affects How You Feel, written for BBC Future, the complex, quote, quickly became notorious for their crime, squalor, and social dysfunction. Critics argue that the wide open spaces between the blocks of modernist high-rises discouraged a sense of community, particularly as crime rates started to rise. As a result, these bleak, prison-like slabs of housing were demolished in 1972. And this is an example that is often discussed when people talk about, like, what's an example of architecture that has a detrimental effect on the people that have to live with it.
Right. I don't want to ascribe ill intentions to the architect, but, like, that is not properly tuned with the well-being of its inhabitants in mind.
Right. Yeah. And it's also worth pointing out the architect does not have sole power over like where a building is constructed or why it is constructed there.
Yeah.
Certainly getting into critiques of segregation.
Of course.
Involving a site like this. But yeah, it also just comes back again that buildings do not exist in their own bubble. They don't exist in a vacuum. And they can certainly contribute to or antagonize existing social problems. So these are just a couple of examples. There are certainly loads of ugly and or joyless buildings in cities around the world, and we keep building them. If you look at the current skyline of New York City, you'll see the full spectrum. You'll see exciting buildings, nostalgic buildings, modern buildings that are quite interesting to look at, modern buildings that make you a little bit angry to look at, and plenty of other buildings that you barely see at all because they are just so lukewarm that your mind cannot even hold them.
But again, coming back to something we talked about in our first episode, the importance of having nearby access to green space with natural vegetation. You kind of can't think about the architecture of New York City, or certainly think about the architecture of Manhattan, without thinking about Central Park.
Yeah.
Central Park, I mean, there's a reason that almost every photo you see of Manhattan has something to do with it. You either get the skyline down from below, or you're looking at part of Central Park.
Yeah, or you get a shot that has the river in it. You have to have that natural element. And moving water is another one that is sometimes factored into these studies. Can a body of water be seen by, say, patients recovering in a hospital, et cetera?
Right.
All right. On that note, we're going to take our first break. But when we come back, we will get further into this question, can buildings damage your mental health? Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, we're back. So we've been talking about brutalist architecture, houses that are and homes and buildings, architectural structures and creations that some may criticize as being ugly or imposing. So I would like to imagine that you take a walk in your own neighborhood and suddenly you see that overnight, like the castle from Krull, the monster, the House of Soviets has emerged in your neighborhood. And you might wonder, well, this may be ugly. I may not like it. I may have questions about what happened to, the park that was formerly in that space. But is it going to actually damage my health? Is it actually going to have some sort of tangible effect on my mental well-being? And in looking at this, we've discussed some of our sources here already. I think I already mentioned Michael Bond's BBC Future 2017 article, The Hidden Ways That Architecture Affects How You Feel. But another source I was looking at is a piece in The Guardian from 2016 by Emily Reynolds titled, Could Bad Buildings Damage Your Mental Health? Reynolds points to some basic stats about urban living, and this came from a 2010 meta-analysis. First of all, people living in urban environments in large cities, 21% more likely to experience an anxiety disorder and 39% more likely to experience mood disorders. And then Reynolds also points to a 2005 study that said people who grew up in a city are twice as likely to develop schizophrenia as those who grew up in the countryside. Furthermore, a 2011 Central Institute of Mental Health at the University of Heidelberg study pointed to a link between urban living and greater stress responses in the amygdala and the cingulate cortex, linked to emotional regulation, depression, and anxiety. So this could have a lasting effect on brain development and mental illness susceptibility, she writes. As Bond points out, this points to the idea that, quote, urban living can change brain biology in some people, resulting in reduced gray matter in the right dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and the perigeneal anterior cingulate cortex, two areas where changes have previously been linked to early life stressful experiences. Now, Reynolds also acknowledges the rather subjective nature of all of this, such as, drastically conflicting studies on open office spaces, like we discussed in our first episode.
Right.
Do they promote pro-social working or are they bad for productivity and well-being? Depends on which study you consult. If you consult me, however, I'll tell you that hell is an open space office.
Yeah. Now, don't you want to collaborate in hell? Don't you really get your jimmies collaborating with the other imprisoned souls?
No, I mean, I take a more of a Dickensian view of hell, where the hell is where you experience the chain that you forged in life. It's not about sharing your chain with other people. But of course, things like this, it's often a careful balance, right? Consider co-housing, in which private homes are clustered around shared spaces. The idea is that unlike dreary apartment towers, they can foster a sense of community through shared spaces. And some studies report this. Others, though, say residents can lose their sense of individuality and privacy. It kind of comes into our varied demands for a natural environment, right? Sometimes we want a place to hide away. Sometimes we need a place to, delight in the sun and share with others. And the natural environment tends to provide us such variety. But once you have an apartment complex plan in place, like that is the environment. And I think this is, again, another area where you have to take into account the careful balance, among the different types of personalities out there, the ups and downs of human moods. You might want to stand in the sun, rejoice in the sun one day, but then you may need to hide in the shadows on another. And those are just the ups and downs of life.
Sure.
Reynolds also quotes Layla McKay, director of the Center for Urban Design and Mental Health, whose think tank has tackled the complex nature of this problem and tried to figure out what are some basic take homes we can acquire from it. And she says the following are key to having a quality architectural design in a living space. First of all, access to nature or green spaces.
We talked about that a good bit in the last episode.
Yeah, this is just a no-brainer and just ties in time to study after study after study. Also, she stresses public spaces that facilitate physical activity and encourage social interaction.
Yeah, this is, for example, one thing people have talked about in the history of city design when cars became ubiquitous in cities, suddenly that streets were no longer a place where people would gather and meet and talk, but instead mm-hmm. there were places that were intraversible because there were fast-moving vehicles going back and forth all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, just there needs to be a place where we can move around and interact with people if we want to. Now, another thing she stresses, living and working in spaces that feel safe.
Sure.
Which, on one hand, is obvious. We don't want to live or work somewhere where we do not feel safe. But that can apply to a lot of things. You know, you can certainly apply that to, say, a whole neighborhood layout. But you can also apply it to things like in our own building, the building in which you and I work. There is our office, and then there is an extremely long, largely featureless hallway that goes to the elevator bank.
It's sort of a John Carpenter hallway. I often think when watching people walk down it ahead of me that there should be a Carpenter soundtrack, you know, kind of a dun-dun.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that that hallway makes me personally feel unsafe or in danger, but it is unnerving, and I feel like it – it does mess with my perceptions a little bit about potential threats. You know, like if someone else is coming down that hallway and I don't want to interact with them, I have no choice. I'm on a train and I'm going to walk past them. And it makes me feel weird. It makes me want to avoid that hallway because on some level, I don't feel 100% safe there. Maybe I feel 90% safe there, but I would rather feel 100% safe, if possible, in the building in which I work.
No, I mean, what you're saying sort of connects to what – I mean, it feels like a, you know, follow the yellow line and escape from New York kind of hallway.
Yeah. I'm also reminded – a friend of mine was telling me about this the Atlanta-based neo-futurist architect John Portman, who is generally best remembered for very large, impressive atriums in hotels, mm-hmm. which they themselves – this was also something that was fairly controversial because you walk into a big hotel and then someone would look up and say, look at all this wasted space. This is not how you build a hotel. A hotel is supposed to be, you know, wall-to-wall rooms. So you get the maximum out of the space. And that's certainly not what you find in his buildings. These are the sort of atriums that you'll sometimes find in science fiction films where mm-hmm. they've clearly filmed it in an enormous atrium in a hotel.
I tend to think these things look really cool.
Yeah, I love them as well. They are very – this kind of design is very much about the interior world, however. And some apparently criticize John Portman for using like internal halls and kind of tunnels to connect buildings to one another rather than using open areas and exposure to nature even. But that does make me wonder if there was true nature to expose people to or if it was a situation where you're cutting them off from like a dreary street.
Yeah. Well, and one thing I like, you know, in some of these big buildings like hotels that have large atriums, I mean, sometimes they will have vegetation within the atrium, mm-hmm. having like trees inside there, which is great.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's certainly ways to bring nature into an indoor environment. Mm-hmm. And some are very extreme. Like I'm reminded of the Opryland Hotel in Nashville, Tennessee, where they
is
have.
Is that the one that's got the rainforest?
Yeah,
in there?
It's like Silent Running. It has the big, big
gate. It's great.
Yeah.
I went there when I was a kid. I loved it.
Yeah, because it's also kind of like going to a Willy Wonka's chocolate factory.
I think I remember believing it possible that I could catch a poison dart frog there.
So in this article by Reynolds, Reynolds points to a frequently cited example, Barbican Estate in London. So this is a brutalist development of terrace blocks and towers built from the 1960s through the 80s. And it's fairly frequently criticized for all the normal reasons people criticize brutalist architecture. But McKay points out that it actually checks off all the boxes that we mentioned above, you know, the nature and the green spaces, the public spaces, the living and working in spaces that feel safe, etc. They do mention, however, that darkness is sometimes a luxury in a place like this, which is also interesting to consider. Coming back to that idea that sometimes you want the shadows, sometimes you don't want the wide open spaces. And certainly, I mean, I've certainly lived in places where I feel like there's just way too much light pollution, and it's kind of hard to find that dark corner in which to actually just sleep at night.
Mm-hmm.
Still, one of the, I think the keys here is this, all of this suggests that a building can be ugly and still be good for mental health, but the design is still key. I think likewise, it sounds like it's very possible to have an outwardly built, a beautiful building that is, would be depressing to live within.
Oh, well, this goes with something that we were talking about that Sarah Williams Goldhagen emphasized in her book that we discussed a little bit in the last episode. It was that, you know, architects often end up thinking most of all about the overall form of buildings, mm-hmm. you know, like the broad sort of like shape and profile of it. But that in fact, for people's direct enjoyment of buildings and, you know, their emotional reactions to buildings, what are actually more important are smaller scale things like surfaces and materials and textures and features.
Yeah.
So I think it's possible you could actually have a building that a lot of people would look at the overall form of from the outside and think it's ugly, but it might be a better place to live in terms of interior surfaces and features and that kind of thing, in addition to the major points we were just talking about with like access to green space and
yeah.
social interaction spaces and all that.
Yeah, the health advantage of having access to a scenic environment. Reynolds also points out that neglected environments contribute to mental ill health, making us feel unsafe, and they may also, quote, contribute to anxiety and persistent low mood. That's from a Centers for Disease Control and Prevention study by Jackson et al. And others have pointed to the signs of social ills, such as graffiti and vandalism, as potentially contributing to this as well. Though I think we have to be careful not to veer directly off into the, like, the broken windows theory of policing in criminal behavior.
Right. Well, a lot of graffiti is fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, there are great graffiti artists. There are parts of Atlanta that are known for their graffiti that that it, you know, provides a beautiful kind of character to the place.
There have been some fabulous public art programs that have been aimed at bringing like large-scale murals to particular, you know, areas with problems as an attempt to just kind of like beautify things and basically have the beneficial side of these effects we're talking about work their way on the inhabitants, and they've generally been very well received. High-rise living, Reynolds writes, might seem like a great idea because, of course, it can afford that killer view, right? You can see the river. You can see the park. You can see green spaces in the distance, et cetera. You know, wealthy penthouses deliver this. But then also someone in community housing would be able to look out at the river as well in a high-rise environment. But the flip side of this is that locations like this can contribute to isolation. It's an area where more study is needed, but again, it shows that you can't just have the view of nature. You know, there are all these other factors as well. And if your view of nature is coming from an isolated tower, it's only going to do so much good, especially if you're not having the social interaction, you're not having any of these other boxes checked off for you by the design. And of course, this leads us to shopping centers and malls, which we might think of them as soul-draining places, but according to the Restorative Potential of Shopping Malls 2016 by Rosenbaum et al., many of these actually have, quote, mentally restorative qualities because, think about it, they're safe, they're open. You know, essentially, a lot of them are like large, you know, enclosed environments, the sort of classic mall, which hopefully people are still getting to experience outside of just viewings of Stranger Things and Chopping Mall.
I mean, some actually have greenery in them, vegetation.
Yeah, and they may be well-maintained. But then the flip side is that there are also places that are highly controlled. And obviously there are places where retailers are using all of their tricks to try and control your behavior, influence your behavior as well. And so that can have ultimately an effect on anxiety and other factors. I also can't help but imagine, I mean, when you go to a shopping place, you're going there to engage with decision fatigue. Mm-hmm. Like whatever your mental state is going in, no matter how nice the greenery, no matter how cool the architecture is, no matter how pleasant the music is, you're still going to potentially find yourself in that situation where you're like, I have no idea what to buy anymore. My brain is depleted.
And a shopping mall almost by definition provides a lot of buying options.
Right.
And having a lot of buying options often contributes directly to those negative feelings associated with shopping.
Exactly. So Reynolds ultimately, you know, writes that with increased awareness of mental health issues and more work in this design area, quote, buildings and public spaces are being designed or at the very least critically analyzed with mental well-being in mind. Now, in Michael Bond's 2017 piece, he's not, maybe that doesn't quite echo as much optimism for the present, but does seem hopeful about the future, writing that, quote, urban architects have often paid scant attention to the potential cognitive effects of their creations on a city's inhabitants. But he did point out that there's a every year the Conscious Cities Conference takes place. In 2017, it took place in London. I read that in 2019, it took place in New York City with a focus on building resilient communities, healthy child development and parenting, reshaping later life, and urban design for mental health. If you want to learn more, you can check them out at theccd.org.
That's the Center for Conscious Design.
Yeah. So Bond points out that recent studies have used actually wearable devices such as bracelets that monitor skin conductivity, a marker of physiological arousal, and smartphone technology to see how we're responding and where we're responding to architecture. Mm-hmm. And so this makes sense. You can strap people up, send them out in the city, and you can see like what's spiking their activity.
Yeah, right. Where are people walking when they're getting stressed and stuff?
Right.
Like, do they tend to be walking past this one horribly ugly featureless building and that's making them more kind of,
Yeah, the factor. And that's exactly what they were looking for. Colin Ellard, who researches the psychological impact of design at the University of Waterloo in Canada, is one of the researchers that's using this kind of technology. And they found that building facades had a huge impact. And they specifically pointed out a, quote, dead zone of, quote, long smoked glass frontage of a Whole Foods store in Lower Manhattan.
All right. So this Whole Foods is directly ruining people's quality of life.
I mean, it's like the swamp of sadness from the Neverending Story. Yeah.
Not solely. But yeah. So they walk past this storefront with the frosted glass and like the – you are detecting physiological signs of stress and anxiety and unhappiness.
Yeah, and it's not because it's like crazy weird architecture. It's not brutalist. It's not covered with graffiti or anything. It's not like you feel unsafe. It's just there, and it's dreary, and it's like what you see everywhere. It's been pointed out as one of the potential threats of you know, the loss of mom and pop stores for sure, but also just places with individual identity as street level. At any rate, cities turn more and more into chain restaurant here, and here's a big box store here, and there's a sameness to everything, and the lack of variety, it takes us out of the sort of variety that we would need in the natural world and would also historically find in a more vibrant city environment. Mm-hmm. Certainly, like, that's what you think of when you think of walking the streets of New York, right? That's the cliche. Not seeing a block of storefront for whatever your big box store happens to be. No, you're expecting to see weird thing here, weird thing here, strange little store here, something up and coming over here. You know, we want that kind of experience. We want the same sort of hike through the wilderness experience, even in our urban environments.
Of course.
Again, we're living in a time though where there's more and more consciousness about mental health though. And we have decades now of studies about the impact of design and things we can do to help, to have like an actual benefit on our mental well-being. For instance, when it comes to social interaction, human interaction, sociologist William Wythe was a key advocate in the 1970s of design that pushed people closer together and encouraged social interaction. And one of his colleagues, Bond writes, founded the Project for Public Spaces, which made key moves such as deploying benches to make certain public spaces more inviting to the public. Put some benches there, make it seem like people are supposed to be here, and then by being here, they will interact with one another in various ways. Another important aspect of city design brought up by Kate Jeffrey, a behavioral neuroscientist at University College London, is that the more lost you feel in a city, the more out of sync, isolated, and potentially afraid you feel. And this is also important inside of a building. So when you walk into the building, do you feel lost? Do you feel like you are in a maze? Because that's not good, because the interior of space should be more like a labyrinth, a place that is maybe complex, that is interesting to behold and experience, but there is not a sense of anxiety about where you are going. When you enter a true labyrinth, you will always go to the center of the labyrinth and back out again. You will always go exactly where you need to go. A maze is the edifice in which you become lost and possibly consumed by a minotaur.
Huh. I don't think I was aware of that distinction.
Oh, yeah.
I've just used them. So
they're often used interchangeably, yeah, even by the best of writers. I try not to get bent out of shape when I'm reading something and they say maze when they mean labyrinth, etc.
It's not as elegant to say Pan's maze.
Yeah, Pan's maze. Yeah, it's not as good. Labyrinth feels more appropriate. All right, we're going to take one more break, but when we come back, we are going to explore the world of hostile architecture.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. Now, Joe, you're the one who turned me on to this idea of hostile architecture. I was blissfully unaware of this.
Well, it's not something I ever had a deep knowledge about. It's just something I'd seen in a few places, and I was just reading a little bit about it online. The idea that sometimes architectural designs that you would use, say, defending a fortress against an invading army can be turned inward and can be used within a society itself, even within a city itself, in ways that are both interesting and sad.
Right. Yeah. Using these features against residents of the city itself, especially the homeless. So one of the older examples of this sort of thing is probably the Flint Cone. A number of you have seen this. I'm going to describe it, and a lot of you will go, okay, I know what you're talking about. This was just deployed in the 19th century in Norwich, England, along with other designs to curb public urination in the city. Because basically, men walking about through the city would need to urinate, and having few options, they would turn to, you know, a handy, dimly lit corner in the exterior of a stone building.
Right.
And that's where they would pee. But such urination, of course, creates an odor, and it even damages materials. So building owners employed a few different strategies against public urination, such as gates around such little corners and nooks and crannies, or even more drastically, filling those corners in with brick and mortar, sometimes in the shape of a cone.
Right. So where you would have a recess that would normally just be a little corner, where you could face into the corner and no one would see what you were doing with the front of your body, instead there's a, you know, human height-shaped cone of bricks and stuff.
Right. That is going to, I guess, cause your urine to flow back towards your feet.
Right. But also just doesn't give you any privacy. Whereas right. Normally this corner would have allowed privacy. Now there is no way to be private there.
Right. Of course, you might not have much of an issue with this, right? You're probably not a huge fan of public urination. But here's the thing. It does not address the root problem. There are people in the city with nowhere to pee. Public toilets were not readily available. Transforming these corners didn't actually solve the problem. It just redirected it to other places, like other corners that didn't have cones implanted in them.
Uh-huh.
And it, you know, ultimately made life even more miserable for the Norwich wanderers who had full bladders. Now, the city eventually made public restrooms more available, but many of these structures still remain, especially the cones, because they are rather permanent in their construction.
Sure.
Now, lack of a place to relieve oneself can still be a problem for the urban homeless today, though this is a problem that is addressed to a large extent by public restrooms, which are deployed with varying degrees of success depending on which city you're looking at and where you are in that city. But like just yesterday, I was outside our own city's zoo, and an individual walked up and asked me where the nearest bathroom was. And naturally, there's one inside the zoo, but that requires a membership or a ticket to get into. Mm-hmm. And I said there was one at the entrance to an adjacent park, but I wasn't sure if renovations were affecting it. And then he said that he tried that one and he couldn't get into it. And then my only suggestion was that, just tell him, well, there's a coffee shop across the street. And of course, a coffee shop is the sort of place where one usually encounters a customers-only policy for restrooms, and in some areas, you even have to have a key or the receipt code off of a receipt to get in there. So the problem still remains. The homeless also need a place to sit and to sleep, a situation addressed to some extent by shelters and other initiatives. But what about these public spaces, these green spaces we've been discussing that have such a benefit for all of us? Like these places have an important impact on our mental wellness, and certainly access is even more vital for individuals on the margins who may also very well be struggling with depression, anxiety, and or mental illness. But unfortunately, there's often an effort then to prevent the homeless from using such areas. And to be fair, if a public space is overrun by homeless individuals, it, you know, I guess it can certainly become less desirable for some members of society. But the result is we see other examples of what critics have dubbed hostile architecture, also known as defensive design, in our modern cities. And here are just a few examples. First of all, park benches with armrests down the middle.
Right. So the goal there is to make a bench that you can sit on, but you can't really lay down on.
Right. Another one, spikes or bolts installed on stairs or on areas of the pavement itself. This is something I've only seen photos of. I don't think I've seen this in real life. But just the idea of like, well, here's a place where one could lay. Mm-hmm. Here's some stairs someone could potentially lay on, but we're going to put spikes there instead. which is a drastic solution.
Yeah.
Another one gates around various fountains, specifically around the edge or the lip of the fountain where one might normally sit.
Mm-hmm.
The placement of boulders or other objects such as bike racks or other structures in place of benches or in spots that were previously popular gathering places for the homeless. Or here's another one, sprinklers that have at least allegedly been placed to deter squatters.
Oh, well, like in parks. Yeah.
Yeah. So some of the – and then as far as benches go, we mentioned the bench with an armrest down the middle. But some of the designs that have been utilized are really quite elaborate, and you might not even recognize their true purpose at first glance, as with the South Philadelphia Transit Authority's modern chrome rib-like benches that look cool. They look like I say, like this weird space curvy rib thing. But as I read in What's Behind the Uptick in Hostile Architecture by Elizabeth Wallace, published in Architectural Digest, the intention here is to create benches that are difficult to sleep on.
Yeah, they're not flat. They've got these ridges in them that will sort of cut into you if you try to lay down.
Yeah, so it's probably a worthwhile exercise, especially for anyone out there who uses like public transportation and visits urban public spaces. Like the next time you see a weird bench or even a beautiful bench, ask yourself, Could I sleep on this? Could I lay down and sleep on this? Could I even set up and sleep on this? And then what does that say? Another example, London's concrete Camden benches have often been criticized for this. And you could they're just, again, this kind of like weird bench design that is like you look at it and you ask yourself, could I lay on that? And the answer is no, not comfortably at all. And you also see variations of this sort of design when it comes to anti-skateboarding features as well that have been retrofitted on things.
I've noticed the others. I've never noticed anti-skateboarding stuff.
Yeah.
Wonder what that's like.
Basically, it's like little like metal ridges, metal bars, things that are added to – and I don't have any skateboarding lingo in my brain. I'm sorry. But the thing
where – just call everything Ollie.
The thing where they ollie along the side of the
ollie,
yeah, or the bench or the concrete by the fountain, put a metal bar somewhere there to disrupt such activity.
Then you can't ollie.
Yeah. So obviously hostile architecture has angered quite a lot of people, inspiring social media campaigns and even sticker and graffiti efforts against the features, because these effects are by their very nature not only anti-homeless but just anti-human. As critics point out, you know, what about older members of society, homeless or not, who simply might need to sit down more often? What if they or anyone else has a health episode? You need to lay down, but oh, you can't lay there because there's spikes coming out of the concrete for no reason, like you live in a Mortal Kombat game.
Yeah, there's a really depressing lack of compassion evident in those. Though at the same time, I mean, to be fair to, I guess, the people who would install things like that, I mean, like the problem is that there are people without a place of their own to lie down or to sleep or something like that. And like the one owner of a building or something can't individually solve the problem.
Right.
And give everyone a place to live. And so like they're just forced to individually deal with their own problem, which is that people keep laying across the doorstep of my building. But it's sad to see that problem dealt with by just like trying to make things even harder for the people who end up sleeping there.
Yeah. Certainly to your point that the individual store owner is not going to solve the wicked problem of homelessness. We call it a wicked problem because it's something with a number of different factors involved in it. It's very difficult to address and to solve. It's the kind of effort that people devote their lives to trying to deal with.
Oh, but I mean, I think there are clearly things you can do to reduce homelessness. I think the evidence is there.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. But in terms of the individual store owner,
right? They can't do it
themselves. But you know, ultimately, the issue is, you know, benches that you can actually sleep on are not going to fix anything. But neither does the presence of hostile architecture, even though it may allow some people to better ignore the underlying problems in society. And that's the thing. Like, it's about making. Ultimately, it makes the problem less visible to segments of the population.
Yeah.
And without actually solving the actual problem.
Yeah, it wouldn't make any sense to blame the homelessness problem to begin with on the individual store owner or homeowner or whatever that's putting these measures in place. But I mean, it does seem like I don't know, this is the kind of thing where you really need collective action, the action through large nonprofits or through the government to try to intervene to solve homelessness more systemically and like actually connect people with places to live rather than trying to come up with ways to make the problem less visible.
Right. Yeah. Ultimately, I would say that metal spikes are never the perfect answer to any given problem. So we bring all this up not to end this two-parter on a really negative note, but ultimately, again, to think about the power of architectural design and the power of architectural objects in our environments.
Well, yeah, and to emphasize again, one of the many ways, I mean, this is what we've been exploring throughout these episodes, is that the designs of cities and the designs of buildings and the designs of public spaces are not necessarily, say, neutral, not necessarily in a moral sense and not necessarily in a public health sense. They are not just a matter of aesthetic preferences. The design of buildings and public spaces in many ways have public health outcomes. They have cultural outcomes and they have moral implications.
Yeah, absolutely. And we live in these environments. So if it is an environment where there are spikes on the stairs, I mean, imagine like growing up seeing that every day and that being just part of your world. And you have to like and asking like, why are there spikes on the stairs, Mom? And they're like, oh, that's so people don't sit on the stairs. That is a weird message to drive home.
Yeah.
So hopefully in these episodes we've explored, you know, the various ways that, that certainly design can make an environment, an artificial environment, more imposing and more negative, but also the ways that they can make it more positive and ultimately more in line with the natural world that we evolved to thrive in.
Totally. My take is less spikes, more trees.
Yes, less spikes, more trees. Big atriums are great as long as they don't have spikes all over them.
I don't know. It's some atrium type spikes can be cool. Like
on the
especially
ceiling.
If they're like spikes within the vegetation.
Yeah. Yeah, well, to go back to Mortal Kombat,
there was
that one stage in the second game where they had the spikes on the ceiling and you would punch someone up into the spikes. But that's a much better design because if someone can still lay on the floor, it's fine. No one's going to trip over something and fall on the spikes. Much better design.
Let's do a finishing move on this episode.
Yes, we're going to have to call it here. Obviously, you know, there's so much we could have talked about additionally concerning architecture and the different styles of architecture, the way different things impact our mind from, sharp angles to spirals and so forth. But we only have so much time. In the meantime, we'd love to hear, though, from certainly any architects out there that happen to be listening to the show or people who have experience with any of the architectural styles, features, or specific sites that we've mentioned on these episodes. We invite listener feedback all the time. Write in. We'd love to hear from you. In the meantime, if you want more Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find the episodes. You'll also find us anywhere you get your podcasts and wherever that happens to be. Leave us some stars. Leave us a nice review. That really helps us out.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you'd like to get in touch with us for any of the reasons we talked about in this past couple of episodes, just to say hi or to suggest a topic for the future, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. this time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was good!
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh?
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
Well, how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.